Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Podcast. For this week's show, we'll be bringing you a Q&A with esteemed filmmaker Whit Stillman and some special guests. At a recent screening of Love and Friendship at the Curzon Soho Cinema, we were lucky enough to be joined by the writer and director Whit Stillman, known for the films Metropolitan, The Last Days of Disco and Damsels in Distress, as well as his spiky Jane Austen adaptation that we were celebrating that night. Next up, you'll hear Whit, along with Master of Ceremonies and Curzon Events Michael Garrad, and very special guests, Love and Friendship breakout star Tom Bennett, known for his work on Phone Shop and the David Brent film Life on the Road, as well as regular Armando Iannucci collaborator Justin Edwards, whose voice you may recognise from The Thick of It and The Death of Stalin. If you want even more of a Whit fix, you can check out his curated collection on Curzon Home Cinema, available now. Without further ado, here is Michael Garrad talking to the great Whit Stillman with Tom Bennett and Justin Edwards.
It's really nice, you know, to host a Q&A at the cinema with a film that's sort of off of the promotional tour. We can kind of get a different sort of perspective, I think, on it. I think a lot of you here will have seen the film or be familiar with the book as well. We're looking forward to hearing your questions, but I am going to start off. So first of all, I understand in previous films that you've made, the script was kind of more fixed at the point you came to production, whereas with Love and Friendship, you developed the roles after casting, particularly those of Sir James and Charles Vernon. Is that correct?
Yes. I think the first couple of films, I started writing an additional scene or something like that. So Damsels in Distress, we needed to explain the bad English accent, and I'd always meant to do that, and we were given an extra day of shooting. So we explained one of the characters' very bad in English accents, which didn't stop everyone on the internet from attacking the actually purposely bad accent. And then we were shooting the pilot for this Amazon series, The Cosmopolitans, in Paris. And Joe Lewis, the executive, said, couldn't we have another scene with Chloe Sevigny? So overnight, I wrote a scene for Chloe Sevigny, which turned out to be like my favorite scene in it. And then I was sort of a little concerned about how limited the script was to dialogue between Kate Beckinsale and Chloe Sevigny. It was very, very dominant. It's dominant in the movie now, but it was even more dominant in the script. And we were having a table reading of the film before we started shooting. You know, all the actors reading the script. And we had one actor represented there on a computer screen. It was just this nice fellow on a computer screen. And he didn't really have any lines in the first third of the film, so he was just there. And the table reading was going really, really badly. It was like tragic. And then suddenly this actor appears on the screen and is just hysterically funny. And I think everyone in the cast said, oh my gosh, this film might not be that bad. And so I saw you know, how great Tom was playing Sir James Martin. And I always thought that what I had of that part was just so underwritten and unfunny. You know, how funny it is. How funny is it really? Church and Hill. You know, what lame material. But it wasn't lame the way Tom did it. And he came for, I think, costume fittings. out to where we were shooting. And already I wanted to try to, well, he's here, he said. And so I said to the producer, can we shoot something while he's here? And they said, we'll have to pay him. So how much is that? And I heard how much. Oh, that's nothing.
Not we'll much.
So I wrote then a scene that... And they said, but we don't have time for Kate. We have half an hour left in our shooting day. We don't have time for Kate to change. So I say, okay, we'll put Kate behind the door. And we'll have Sir James Martin at the door talking about the carriage. So that's how we shot that scene. And then as we are going along, there are just sort of more and more things thinking of for Sir James Martin as played by Tom Bennett. And so it really changed the film.
One thing that's really interesting, I think, about Sir James's dialogue is that his dialogue is very different to the others. The other characters have got a very precise way of speaking and very articulate, and Sir James is often quite stilted. He's punctuated by laughter and so on. Okay, I don't know if you could talk about how you developed this sort of stylistic difference in the speech.
Well, anyone with a keen ear for dialects might notice I don't naturally sound like everyone else in the film. So there's probably a lot of that, really. I don't naturally come from this background. I don't sound like that. I seem to be able to inhabit idiots very quickly and very efficiently, which is good, because the 12 Commandments scene, I was handed in the makeup chair. And I said to the second assistant director, oh, okay, great. When does Witt want to shoot this? Oh, as soon as you're out of hair and makeup. So, and luckily, I'm playing an idiot who doesn't quite know what he's talking about. So lots of it was happy accident. That I'm searching for the word. Yeah, and that's the word. So I think that, I don't know. I think it was all a kind of happy accident.
Yeah, well, I think as in my earlier question, I mean, this is quite unusual, I think, for your filmmaking, Witt, to be introducing lines quite that late into the process. And the 12 Commandments joke is I think it's one of my favourites in the film. And this, as you say, came about at quite a late point. The Commandments is also a key point in the film. It's referenced several times. So could you?
It's very odd how all that happened. There was a point where we had a potential investor in the film who's a devout Christian and wanted to invest in Christian films. So suddenly I started racking my brain for how we could get Christian themes into the movie. So suddenly there, I had a little sermon I wanted to deliver about aesthetics, so that became the church scene. And then I do feel that as a father, I feel that young people should honor their mother and father. I feel that very strongly. So we got the commandments in there. And then we had a delightful apostate Catholic producer who at one point mentioned the 12 commandments. And I said, save that. We have a scene for Sir James Martin. And for me, what really made that scene worthwhile was, okay, the 12 commandments. But then the idea that there are two you can take off. There are only 10 commandments you have to obey, but there are 12 commandments, so there are two you get to take off, or whatever. And so it was just a revelation the way that all the actor pulled it out of the fire, as we said.
I'd like to bring Justin into the conversation. I think I'd like to talk about Charles Vernon. He's a very kindly diplomatic character who is one of the few characters that looks warmly upon Sir James. I'd just like to ask, you know, what was the difference, say, between when you originally drafted this character and then how you worked together to develop the final character?
Well, to go first, I think in the casting process, we sort of knew we wanted Charles Vernon to be bigger than it was in the Jane Austen original and in the original script. And so I think... my impression is that we were adding material for Justin. I think we were expanding what we had from the...
I think so, because when I first read the script, there wasn't as much as I ended up saying. But I think, going back to Tom's point of him being able to inhabit... He says inhabit idiots, just Tom being able to be an idiot so swiftly and quickly. I think, again, because I do tend to play kind of well-meaning but vague men. I think when I auditioned for you, I was particularly tired and I hadn't had a chance to learn the script. Well, in fact, you were able to see, yeah. So well, I was just sort of reading it from a camera. Going, well, I don't know if this... Sorry, I can't remember that bit. No, go on. And then I thought, well, that won't get that job. And then... Of course, yes. The next thing that happens, oh, that's exactly what we wanted. I was like, good, because that's all I can do.
One of the lines that I particularly like from your character, and we see that again at the very end of the film, is that I will find the citation. Yeah, it was. Was this something that was? Did this come in like the 12 Commandments thing, kind of late into the process, or was it always in there?
Well, there were a couple of those repeats where various people say he's no Solomon quite often, and things, but he's a bit of a rattler. Like they do, that people are listening to each other, thinking, oh. I'm going to say that later. That's a good line, which is sort of, you know, not uncommon within that sort of...
I think also when you're presenting a film that's going to be referring to all kinds of things that people might not be getting, and they'll be very angry that you have something in a film that they're not getting, if you sort of talk about researching it further and checking the citation, it puts us all in the same boat. Yeah. We're saying stuff we're not really sure validity of anything.
Well, I think it did come, because when... Did it come in later, that bit, when you said, in her mean... And I'm in a script, and everyone's going, no one's going to know what that means. Oh, well, in that case, I'll make you explain it quite consistently and then until people are bored, and then they won't care. Maybe that's...
That's how the idea came into the film of having text on screen, because I thought that no one would understand what we're saying with mean from that poem. So we'll actually just put the text of the poem on the screen and people will know what he's talking about with mean. And then we'd done that and we said, well, we can do this with a letter too in the earlier thing. So the letter went back there.
Yeah, I think the letter, when the text comes up on the letter, this obviously you've adapted I can't pronounce it, epistolary. I went to an
epistolary.
Essex Comprehensives. They don't teach you this kind of thing. a letter is kind of, you know, a very good technique for a novelist to sort of get to the thoughts of a character. But it's I think that's a bit of a struggle for a filmmaker to bring to the screen someone writing and reading a letter. So I like the way that this is illustrated, and that the problem of adaptation itself is kind of illustrated in that moment.
I thought we had sort of eliminated... I mean, the big temptation in adapting the epistolary novel was to have tons of letters in the movie and people reading letters and all that. And I thought we'd sort of purged the film of letters, essentially. But in watching it afterwards, I see there are actually quite a few letters in important moments. So there's that letter, and then there's the letter that comes with the marriage of Sir James, and that kicks off your long disquisition about love.
Reasons for marriage, yeah. But what's that? It's just that nice moment when I say, yes, no, it happens all the time, that basically that women marry idiots, and then you're just on Emma's face, very, very placid, and not sort of saying, but yeah.
Smiling. She smiles.
Yes.
I'd like to ask you about Tom and Justin, about your scenes together. I think that Justin and a lot of the characters in the film, the humour is in the words, and I'm not an actor, right? So forgive me if I'm saying something dumb now, but when you deliver them, you almost have to have kind of quite like a straight kind of way of delivering it in order to allow the humour to really come out. Whereas with the Sir James character, they're very contrasting kind of performances. I'd like to know how you sort of work together, or
well, I mean, I'd like to say we sat down days beforehand and worked this all out. But
we workshopped, I think, two or three weeks.
Yeah, several. We really spent a long time going through all of this to pick up and make sure we were on different rhythms and cadences. But the truth of it is, it was quite last minute, insofar as that Whit doesn't like to give you a shooting schedule either. So you don't know what you're filming until the night before, when the same thing says, these are the scenes tomorrow. And you go... That's
a big one, isn't it?
There's a lot to do. So I think because you don't like actors to prepare, if that's, you know, right, or you don't like to be over-rehearsed or overthought and keep it quite spontaneous, which is, it's quite tricky with this. I think Kate might have had a bit more advance notice, because that amount of dialogue and her precision.
She's got quite a lot of words.
Yeah, she's actually had a lot of words to say, and she remembered them all.
Nearly all of them.
Nearly all of them. So I think it's hard to do with that. So I think, yeah, it was a lot of it was discovered, let's say, sort of in the moment, but
In my defense.
Yeah.
In my defense.
Oh, I'm not criticizing. Nice.
We have, I mean, there is a scripted script, which is most things, and I think those you did have.
Yes.
And I think we knew what days we were shooting those things, so you would know what day you were shooting those. But in the case of these two guys, we were trying to get, you know, more gold out of the mind. Yeah. Because we'd already agreed to pay them a certain amount, and if we could extract more comic gold, it's a better deal for us.
Yeah. You've already flown me out to Dublin.
What more?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, did you find by working with a non-canonical text, obviously this is a novella that Jane Austen wrote when she was about 19, I think, did working with a non-canonical text, did that mean you were more free to adapt than, say, if you adapted, you know, Pride and Prejudice?
Well, I think that the prospect of doing the great Jane Austen masterpieces, to reduce them to a 90-minute film with all the sort of commercial pressures to make them wedding-oriented romances, would have been really kind of depressing prospect. In this case, it was like we were into extra time or extra credit, and whatever we did bring it to the screen would be sort of creating this for an audience that wasn't paying attention to it. But actually, I think we are closer in this adaptation to the original material than almost all the other adaptations. She wrote a really funny manuscript, and what was encouraging was she had left it an early draft, hadn't finished it, so it was sort of, we had permission to sort of try to finish it in a way. We can't finish it the way Jane Austen would have finished it, which would have been wonderful, but we could finish it in our way. And I think it helped a lot having the new material with these actors and other actors coming in to make it not just letters between, I mean, sort of adapting letters between the Kate character and the Chloe character.
I guess one of the things about the Lady Susan character and why, you know, maybe it was attractive to you to adapt this novella is in your other films, maybe correct me if you don't agree with this, but you're looking at a similar society situation similar to Jane Austen and using them in a 20th or 21st century setting. Here, I think with Lady Susan, she's, you know, in some ways we can see her as a very modern character. She's a single mother. She's very witty. She's very clear in her aims and so on. I mean,
she's pretty much Kate Beckinsale. So seeing Kate in a Cold Comfort Farm was a really inspiration when I was writing the script for Last Days of Disco, which we screened last night, and you know, struggled to grab her, get her to do that, and then when I read this, I wasn't when I first encountered the original of Lady Susan. It was just shortly after we'd shot Disco, and Kate was very young. And one of the things that encouraged me about the material was Kate Beckinsale could play this really well. It'd be really great with Kate Beckinsale. But then it was like sort of 12 years before she'd be the age to play that part. And I dawdled in writing the script at 12 years, and things worked out.
I want to talk a little bit about the book and some more recent things shortly, but I think it's a good time to open to the audience if you've got any questions about the film.
I'm quite interested in the special relationship of the American characters and the English, you know, talking about people being scalped in Connecticut, whereas all the English guys are complete blithering idiots. I mean, is this the revenge of the American?
Oh, I didn't see it that way. So I had this experience with Damsels in Distress with one of the American actors pretending to have a British accent, and it's revealed that she was in London for 4 weeks and she came back with this fake accent, which many people do. And we were so, so criticized by people who, you know, even though it's revealed at the end, I'm not sure if they got to the end, they just sort of attacked us for this bad accent, which was intentional. And so I was sort of allergic to the whole idea of an accent struggle of people, because no matter how good Chloe's accent was, no matter how good a job she did, people would be aware she's American and someone's going to find fault with it. And so at one point, we initially were going to try to have her be English, but then someone said, well, you know, why couldn't she be American? And I'd read just so much about that period and the Tory exiles from the United States, the loyalists who came back to London. There was the Delancey family where they were in New York and they went to Eton and Oxford and the inns of whatever, the inns for studying law. And they went back to the United States where they became, you know, the governors of the provinces. And so they quickly exiled themselves to London when our War of Independence started. And so there were a lot of characters like this. And I just knew that with the sort of attitudes between the two countries, after having done this film Barcelona years ago, the European-American attitudes, there's a lot of jokes, and that Connecticut could be a punchline. And Chloe and I both have origins in Connecticut, so it's sort of a joke for us. And a pleasure of this tour with the film was showing it in Hartford, Connecticut, where all that got a big laugh.
Could you please talk a little bit about the music across your films? Because in Metropolitan, in this one, the kind of score is an overlay generally, whereas in, say, like Disco, which has such an effervescent soundtrack, it's very intradiegetic and features mainly where the characters can hear what's going on. So, and then obviously in this film as well, Frederica's singing is part of her reticence to be open and in front of an audience. So if you could elaborate a bit on that, please. Thank you.
Music is really important in the editing of our films, and there's sort of a traditional way of doing films where the films would be edited and then turned over to a composer, and the composer would do a score, which would then be recorded. And I've just heard of very many disasters where the music that is done doesn't match, and it's sort of hit or miss thing. And we love the idea of having music that already existed in some form and editing to that music and knowing exactly in our sort of test screenings exactly what the emotional reaction was going to be. I have seen films that I think are really good films but are kind of wrecked by the music. And so we wanted to be really, really careful about the music and how it changes the tone of everything. And so in the case of Metropolitan, there was sort of composer music, Smetana and Gilbert and Sullivan, but there was a lot of demos from the composer Tom Judson, who initially worked on the film and left us with many melodies from sort of his trunk. So we're cutting to Tom Judson melodies, and then Mark Suazo was writing other material, and so we've worked with Mark Suazo on everything. And in the case of this film, we were going back and finding semi-period music. It's much earlier. It's generally Baroque music in the movie, but we felt since it's earlier, that's permissible. So we were really cutting the film to this music, and then we recorded it in Dublin, the Windmill Lane Studios, and just some incredibly wonderful opera singers and musicians. We found out that the Irish Film Orchestra and the Irish Baroque Orchestra exactly overlap. So they were very quick to pick up on all the Baroque music.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. Yeah, we see a lot of films with synthesized string arrangements or pianos and so on. So it's really nice to hear, real instruments playing. I mean, actually, you're in Death of Stalin, and that's also got very beautiful music that's very...
He composed.
He conducted it.
Yeah, I wasn't... Well, I sort of. I was allowed to conduct an orchestra very briefly, but they were instructed not to pay great attention to me. It would have been a mess, but yeah.
But your character conducted.
My character's actually beautifully, and very truthfully. Yeah.
One of the many great delights of your work is the spoken word. Can you talk about how you visualize that? Do you see kind of these tracking shots when you're writing the screenplay, or do you kind of come up with the compositions more when you're discussing it with the heads of department and the working process with that, please?
this kind of film, the walk talk, is like the standard thing we rely on, because we want to say a lot of things. There's a lot of dialogue. There's a lot of story in dialogue. And we want people to be able to look at something as interesting as possible while there is the dialogue. So the walk talk is important in all these things. And I think the actresses in Damsels in Distress were always talking about speaking quickly and walking slowly was the instruction from the camera crew, because they'd run out of track. They don't want to set too much track. But as far as the spoken word, I really try to speak everything. And I think I annoy people in the cafes where I'm writing, because I have headphones on listening to other music, but speaking the dialogue as I write it, and trying to, when in revising things, always trying to speak everything, so that when it gets to the actors, you know, it's humanly possible to speak it. Maybe they disagree, but I thought it was humanly possible.
But certainly some of the longer scenes, I know Xavier Samuel was always very keen to move. He's a young man. And us old writers, I'm quite able to sit down for the whole scene. That's all right.
We prefer just standing in one spot.
Much easier. Don't touch anything. There's no continuity. But Xavier was always, can I sort of walk across the room during this bit? And you were just very politely going, no. No, because it would just, you know, you obviously knew how you wanted it to play out. And in fact, all the scenes, I think, work beautifully, because everyone is quite sort of desperately trying to hold on to some sense of, you know, propriety and decorum. I'm going to stand here and look. Well, in fact, the very funny scene with Tom, where it is that extraordinary speech about Churchill, is almost sort of one take. And you cut to the back of his head a couple of times, but it's mostly just one.
It's very unfussy editing. By and large, they're locked off. You know, a dirty two or a single, because the dialogue is that good, you can just sit there and watch it. It doesn't need flashy cuts or, you know, pans or crashes. You want to watch that, and so actually, it's a beautifully composed shot, but it sits there and invites you to listen.
That's a really long scene when Sir James Martin arrives and goes into his disquisition.
I could have done it quicker, or
double disquisition about Churchill. And so I, as the writer, I was really aware of all the repetition, so I was thinking, well, we can't have that repetition, we've got to take that out. And so we tried it sort of, and it was so much better just going on and on with Church and Hill and Church and
repetition. I'm a fan of the group The Fall. I don't know if you know them. Their first single had got a song called Repetition, which it said, these are the three R's: repetition, repetition, repetition. A little digression there. I just want to ask, we've got a few minutes left, and I just want to ask a couple more questions. Firstly, about the book, because I think it's interesting to think about Sir James's character in terms of the book. Obviously, we you know, seeing the film, we're encouraged to laugh at Sir James's character, but there is some dialogue which in the film which is quite sympathetic to him, and in the book you've kind of or your narrator, who is a nephew of Sir James, aims to rehabilitate the character of both Sir James and Lady Susan. I just want to ask you about how it was to revisit your character and sort of switch the perspective.
Well, the story of the Love and Friendship novel, which we have tons of copies upstairs and we'll be anxious to sell you as many as you'll take, I'm going to buy them for these guys because they inspired a lot of the novel. So what happened was, I was struggling with this project, not getting it financed, but I had a script that uniquely among the scripts I'd written, people enjoyed reading, because it's based on really good Jane Austen material, and it was sort of a dramatization of this epistolary novel. And so a publisher looked at the script and offered to make it a novel, wanted a novel, even without knowing there was going to be a film. And so I had the contract, well in advance to do this novel, but of course I hadn't started it, and was frantic. I was supposed to turn in the novel before we started shooting, but you're frantic preparing things. And so I didn't do that. But the moment we stopped the picture edit, I faced that and said, I don't want to just do a dramatization of, you know, the original. And I had the experience of working with these actors and all this comic material that came out. And among the research for the novel was reading her nephew's memoir of her. Like, the only things we really know about Jane Austen is from this memoir, her Victorian, rather wealthy, rather aristocratic, pretentious nephew, you know, I guess the the father had married well, or the and so he was sort of in a different class than Jane Austen. So he's looking back in her era and her family, sort of with the Victorian snobbery, a bit of class snobbery. It's very deprecating and pretentious. And then I was thinking of Sir James Martin, and Sir James Martin married Lady Susan. His sister's son would be Lady Susan's nephew, and to have this nephew adoring his aunt and defending her from everything, so turning everything around, everything bad about her becomes good. And so it gave us a lot of comic material, and also even the Charles Vernon character, there was sort of a lot more material there about Charles Vernon just from Justin's performance that I could use in the novel to expand that, because I mean, it's really wonderful, the original Jane Austen, but it's sort of sensory deprivation because it's just so much the two women writing each other. And we actually include that in the novel too, so it's really a two-for-one book, because we include the original Jane Austen, beautifully printed and set off. And then we have Rufus Martin Colonna's comments on that text, which he disagrees with almost everything. And so it's... it's a very complicated novel, I have to say.
So I think, yeah.
Some laughs.
Yeah, to mention briefly, there is commentary on the Ten Commandments or the Twelve Commandments, and Sir James is vindicated in the book also that there are...
there's a reason for
there
that,
are,
yes.
There are extra commandments.
Accidentally, he got it right.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So we do have to wrap up very shortly, but I do want to ask... In some of your films where you've used the same actors sometimes, you know, or sometimes they're playing the same part. In Last Days of Disco, you have characters from Metropolitan and Barcelona, but you also use the same actors in different roles, and as well with Love and Friendship, and also with your upcoming television series, Cosmopolitan, and both Tom and Justin will be in that. Is it, if you could talk a little bit about that, and I think as well with the continuity of actors, I wonder if you're encouraging us to see a relationship between, for example, the characters in Last Days of Disco and Love and Friendship, and also the characters in Love and Friendship and Cosmopolitan upcoming.
Well, that would be like 30 minutes, so I'll reduce it to two. So it is true that it's a huge inspiration to know the actors and see what they do and be in the editing room watching the delights of their performance and cutting out the best part and just leaving the other. So you're also then writing something and you just want the actors to come back. You know, how can they come back? And so in the Cosmopolitans, we did a pilot for Amazon a while ago, and they gave me a commission to write the scripts, and Amazon's changed direction. All my friends have been sacked, as usually happens. And so it might not be at Amazon, but I think it'll be somewhere. And so there are parts for Justin and Tom. And so I really hope that'll happen and we'll be able to work together again.
Okay, great. Can we just say one more question?
Just short question. I was just wanting to know a little bit more about your writing process. You mentioned going to cafes and so on, but typically these films are very heavy on the word and the dialogue. So how long does it take you to write the script, and how often in the day do you write and so on and so forth?
Well, if you can try to think of sort of the most embarrassing process imaginable, the most embarrassing way to do something inefficiently, you know, lazily, everything bad, that's my process. So, you know, sometimes I think it's like, you know, 90 minutes a day, you're actually doing something worthwhile. But one of the crazy things is that, like, the best ideas never come when you're sitting down trying to write. It's always when you're in the movie Barcelona, we have a lot of shaving jokes, because when I'd sort of go to finally shave, all the ideas would come. And going down the stairs, I don't have many going down the stairs jokes, but going down the stairs, suddenly you get all the ideas are walking. And so I just find it really horrible, the starting a new project. And I think one of the charms of doing the novel was to be able to continue in the same world with the same characters and using the material we have and expanding on and adding new things. And in a TV show, I guess one of the attractions is to be able to keep the same actors and characters going and adding to that. I find the really, really painful thing is originating it, that, you know, I just think it's just terrible what I first write. It's just horrible, horrible, horrible. And it's not until you get to the thing of rewriting finally and all that. But thank you very much for that question.
Thanks so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed that Q&A. In the meantime, if you'd like to subscribe to the show, we put out a new episode every week, and you can do so by visiting iTunes and Acast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.